Welcome to an all-new episode of the McFuture Podcast. I'm Steve Factor, and today I have an amazing guest. And I know I've said that before, and maybe you haven't been amazed. This time, I demand that you're amazed. If you're not, I will come over and shake you until you are amazed. My guest is the former chief economist for the World Bank. He's authored countless economics books. And when I say countless, you could count them. I didn't. And he's a Nobel Prize winner. I lost that one by a really small margin. I sat down with Columbia professor Joseph Stiglitz. And whether you agree with his worldview or not, Professor Stiglitz is an advisor to all kinds of world leaders. And on top of that, he's not afraid to stir controversy. Just wait and hear what he says about investor Peter Thiel in this episode. In our conversation, we covered everything: inequality, unemployment, monopolies, jobs, education, saving Europe. If I had a dollar for every time someone came up to me and said, "Steve, listen, I've been working on saving Europe, have no idea what to do. You gotta help me." Well, you're in luck. There is a caveat to this episode. This conversation took place in 2016, just before the election. So you might be thinking to yourself, "Steve, you have a very interesting release schedule for your podcast." Well, there's a reason why this happened. At the time, I had just launched the podcast, and I was spending a ton of time getting all of these top guests like Larry King and Jim Jeffries and Jesse Ventura and Joseph Stiglitz, and I was spending even more time writing articles about those interviews, editing the episodes so they don't sound like every other show where I would drop in the interviews into a larger storyline. And what I realized was I was spending all of this time telling other people's stories and completely neglecting the ideas that I wanted to share. Larry King does not need my help getting his message out. Now, he might need divorce attorneys, heart surgeons, and other services that I can't provide, but he certainly doesn't need my podcast. And unfortunately, that meant leaving certain episodes, as great as they were, on the shelf. And so I just reached this point where I couldn't justify anymore spending all that time presenting other people's ideas, especially not the way I wanted to, in a really creative and original way. But today I'm in a very different place. There are specific topics I'm really excited about. And the guests I have on are people who can lend credibility and depth and insight to each of those. And since my next one is on the future of jobs, who better to talk to than a Nobel Prize winning economist? And what's interesting is every single thing we talked about is as relevant, if not more relevant today than it was back then. And I apologize to Joseph Stiglitz. I'm going to put his latest book, because I think he's like four books in since this thing was recorded. So I'm going to put that link into the show notes, as well as the book that he was originally promoting. And hopefully you check it out. Also, don't forget to sign up for the Patreon. There's a great member-only episode out right now about Idiocracy. You won't want to miss it. And if you want to support the show, that's the best way to do it. Anyway, here's my conversation with Professor Joseph Stiglitz. We are here with Professor Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel laureate, author of many, many bestsellers on economics. Thank you for joining us.
Nice to be here.
Today, I want to talk to you about a couple of things. First, you just wrote a book on Europe, and I want to get into it, but just overall, I'd love to get your thoughts. You're such a prolific writer and thinker on economics. Are people listening? Do you get the feeling that they care?
Yes, I do. I mean, obviously, economics is important to people. They care about their livelihoods, their security. It's probably the number one thing, and there are other values too, but obviously it's important. It's also clear things have not been going very well. No matter what side of the political spectrum, there is a perception that things are better than they were at the bottom of the recession, but that's not not a good benchmark. The fact is, large fractions of America face a lot of insecurity. One of the most disturbing statistics that came out at the end of last year was that for large groups of Americans, white males, middle-aged, less well-educated, life expectancy is going down. Death rates are going up from suicide.
So I started eating kale.
From a whole variety of social diseases. That's disturbing. This doesn't happen very often. Everywhere else, life expectancy is increasing. So it's something America has always talked about, exceptionalism, American exceptionalism. This is a way we don't want to be exceptional. It's, to me, symptomatic. There is this quest for understanding what is wrong. I think some of my work provides some insights into what is going wrong.
When you look at certainly all of these populist uprisings out there with Trump and Bernie, are you seeing something close to revolution, or are people that frustrated? I mean, you mentioned a lot of these symptoms.
What is very clear, both in the United States and in Europe, is that there is a great deal of dissatisfaction with their lives, with their security. In some cases, it's people still who have jobs, but they're worried about whether they'll have a job tomorrow, whether if they lose a job, they'll get another job, whether their children will have a lifestyle comparable to one that they have. What is striking is that these concerns even arise among people who are today doing well. There is an anxiety in the country.
There's a lot of people talking about automation and this technological unemployment that some say is inevitable. Are you seeing that as well? Are there going to be enough jobs for 10 billion people on the planet?
As the number of people increase, the demand for goods increases. Now, technology means that we can be more productive. We have a decision about what to consume and how much to consume, how much leisure to have. In a well-functioning society, even with technical change, there can be full employment. It may be that, like, you know, today compared to 100 years ago, we work a shorter week. That's fine. The worry is that the work that is available will go to a relatively small group of people, or even a large group, but there will be a large group of people left out. That's really the worry, that it's not whether we can create hours of work. The question is how those hours of work are shared.
Well, so that brings me to this idea of interventionism. We tend to intervene to fix something that we notice isn't working. But those things also have unintended consequences. Perfect example is our tax code. It's a mess. It's a million lines of rules and regulations, farm and oil subsidies. So we've put them on the books and then they're there forever. So how do we intervene in a way that doesn't create all these unintended consequences?
You're absolutely right. We began with an understanding that markets often fail to produce the kind of efficient outcomes Adam Smith might have thought that the people on the conservative side think. Very clear that markets often do not work. We would have too much pollution, too little innovation. So there is a need for government intervention. The difficulty is, of course, that in a democracy, there's political processes, and those political processes are very complicated. And if they're not structured right, there's always the danger that the powerful use those political processes rather than creating a more just society, a fairer distribution, creating more security, use that to enhance their own well-being.
Yeah.
So make greater inequality. The main check on that is not so much our system of checks and balances within the government, but checks and balances within our society. And for those checks and balances to work, there has to be a modicum of equality. You know, you don't have to have complete equality, but when you get to extremes of inequality of economics, that economic inequality, economic power gets translated into political power. And that's why the agenda of doing something about our great divide, about our inequality, is not just an economic agenda, it's a political agenda. It runs into a problem that the powerful don't want that.
Of course.
But that's where democracy comes in. It's a fight. You know, I used to joke that in the context of reforms of our banking system, it was clear our banking system was not doing what it was supposed to do. It was not leading to more growth. It was leading to more instability, more inequality, engaged in really abusive practices. 75% of Americans or more thought we needed more regulations. And 10 banks had as much power as 75%. We got more regulation, but far from what was needed because of the power of those 10 banks. So that shows you that there is great inequality. But it also shows you when citizens get engaged enough, their voice is heard. And it happened to some extent. We got more bank regulation. They didn't want any, and we got some. So I view that as a victory. It's a fight. These fights are not easy. Let me give you another example. 70% or more of Americans believe we ought to raise the minimum wage. At the bottom, our wages are comparable, adjusted for inflation, to what they were 60 years ago. Can you imagine at the bottom, no pay raise for 60 years? That's a source of, could be a cause for revolution. It's not, but there still is hope that our political system works. Congress won't do it. Republicans in Congress say, we're not going to raise the minimum wage. Fortunately, what's going on in city after city across the United States, there is this fight for 15 to raise the minimum wage. And as each city succeeds in doing it, and they show that it doesn't have the adverse effects that the naysayers said would happen, there's more and more momentum for this fight for 15.
There's a broader context for that. The Fortune 500 used to be 35% of the economy in 1955. Today it's 72%. And almost 50% of the economy is 100 companies. That's a crazy level of concentration. So just in terms of overall power, how do you counterbalance that? We don't have unions anymore. We don't have a lot of the mechanisms that used to exist when things were certainly more egregious in terms of abuses. Now the abuses are kind of subtle. It's like, hey, the CEO is getting 400 times what the average worker gets. No one really notices and pays attention. And so minimum wage is just this one concession at the low end. It does very little to address the broader power structure.
You're absolutely right. Statistic, though, that I think is even more telling is the increase in the rates of return to capital in corporations. The real interest rate, T-bill rate, is negative, and yet the returns to capital are soaring. That says, again, that there's a lack of competition in our economy. The main instrument was one that Teddy Roosevelt talked about 100 years ago, competition policy, antitrust, breaking up these big, large corporations. We don't need to have too big to fail banks. No evidence that they perform better. Break them up, they'll be just as efficient without the political and economic power.
In terms of breaking up banks, Peter Thiel, who you're familiar with, is a big proponent of monopoly. And his argument, essentially, I'm not going to do it justice in a short spurt here, but he essentially is saying that these monopolies, as they get bigger at scale, are so much more efficient that customers are better off because they're so good at providing a service that lots of competitors would just eat away at each other and erode each other's margins rather than provide a better service.
Peter Thiel should study a little economics. The real test of his theory is what's been happening to the typical American. Typical American has a real income adjusted for inflation, takes account product quality changes, all this innovation that is roughly comparable to the was a quarter century ago. That's a failed economy. The problem is you can't tell when or whether that disruptive event is going to occur. And so you have to put in a regulatory framework that is robust enough to deal with situations where that disruptive event doesn't occur. I was involved in the White House in the discussions leading up to the Telecommunications Act of 1995. And actually, in that discussion, we focused exactly around the question that you asked. There was one school of thought that said, leave it to the market. There will be some event. The market is going to be competitive. Don't worry. And the other school of thought said, maybe, but maybe not. And we have to have in place a institutional structure that would break up and stop anti-competitive practices should they occur. That was a case that those in the cautionary side turned out to be right. You know, we began with one company, AT&T. We broke it up into eight companies, and there were some new entrants, and it looked for a while like we were going to have a robust competitive marketplace. India had originally a robust competitive marketplace, and now we've converged to what people say is two and a half firms with prices in many areas 10 times that would prevail in a more competitive market environment. We didn't put in place the strong precautionary measures, partly because, in fact, there were complex issues dealing with state regulations versus national regulations. The bottom line is one has to also be very aware of monopolies, once established, often persist even after the situation which gave rise to that monopoly power changed. So, for instance, take Microsoft. Its dominance in the PC market has persisted even after the court rulings that stopped its very anti-competitive practices prohibited it from doing some of those things. They had this FUD, you create uncertainty, doubt about whether there was interoperability, and that would discourage other applications, other browsers, quirks, and all continents ruled that that was anti-competitive. But once you establish your market power, it can persist for a very long time. Eventually, it may erode, but the damage to the economy that occurs can be very great. One more example, in Mexico, they did not have a competitive telecom sector, and the prices there were 10 times that of the United States, which I mentioned were probably 10 times that of India. The result of that is Mexico could have developed as a Spanish call center, but with those kind of telephone prices, that did not happen.
So let's switch gears a little bit. I want to talk to you a little bit about Brexit. When I first heard about it, I'm like, okay, I don't get all of this craziness, because to me, it seemed very administrative in nature, because there are countries, Switzerland, Norway, Iceland, that exist outside of the EU and are perfectly fine. They negotiate their deals and trade policies, and things move on. Besides this administrative shift, is there something else that warrants the panic or the level of panic that happened when it was first announced?
I'm on the side that there was probably excessive panic. And the reasoning was very similar to your reasoning. There are multiple arrangements. A key issue was free migration. I think there is, even among economists who believe that migration is a good thing, a recognition that it can occur at a pace that is difficult for a society to manage.
And destabilizing.
And therefore be destabilizing, and not result in the benefits not that one would hope not being realized. Those who have their wages depressed are not being able to help those, and therefore leading to political consequences. So some of this was about the issue of whether one could have a more regulated migration system. In a way, this illustrates another flaw in the euro system, in the eurozone, not the eurozone, but in the EU system. It was the same kind of idea, motivated by idealism, motivated by a vision that they wanted a united Europe, and that in a united Europe there has to be free migration of labor. That was a reasonable goal. Question was, should one stretch oneself to get to that goal right away, or should there be a more paced way of getting there with a real commitment? I mean, I understand the fear was that if you didn't do it right away, there'd be backing off. The question is, if you do it right away, there may be a backing off. That's a political judgment.
It's like they did basically a NAFTA within Europe, where you unlock the doors and say, okay, let's start trading freely. And when everyone's starting from a different level, you're going to have a lot of discomfort, especially the ones who are losing something in that exchange.
And interestingly, when NAFTA was being discussed, no one proposed free migration of labor. Because we said we can get a lot of the benefits from the free mobility of goods and services without free migration of labor. Which doesn't mean that we do have absolutely closed borders. That issue of what is the right degree of openness, like the degree of what is the right degree of coordination of exchange rates, should have been perhaps more discussed. In other words, one of the big lessons I learned as chief economist of the World Bank was pacing and sequencing matters. Having the right goals, the right vision, having the heart at the right place sometimes doesn't suffice.
Do you think that because these overarching administrative layers, you can call them countries in some cases, or you can call them, you know, EU, which was put in later on, because of the way that they implement these, you know, these new rules, and they may not be fair, they may not be paced correctly, is this going to inspire other secessionist movements? You look at Quebec, Catalonia, Scotland, Texas, you know, like there's always a rumbling in one of those places about well, the country no longer serves the needs of this, you know, this region. Do you think that they're going to be encouraged by this Brexit move?
It probably won't happen in the United States. We had a war over that issue.
Remember, yeah.
And it was a very costly war, and I think that issue is being settled. From a broader philosophical point of view, the question is, in the 21st century, what is the right form of political and economic integration? There is, I think, too much focus on a simplistic view of sovereignty. We've all given up some degree of sovereignty when we have trade agreements that...
Or move into a co-op. Everywhere.
Everywhere. If you're going to have cooperation, that nature of the cooperation is, we say we have to cooperate within a certain...
Yeah.
set of rules. So the notion that you're giving up sovereignty seems to me exaggerated. But the issue is, when can you, what are the degrees of, and the circumstances, the activities over which you give up that sovereignty? Now, in Europe, they have a very important principle they call subsidiarity, which says that you want to delegate to the lowest level possible, keeping at the higher level activities where there are externalities, where what one country does affects another country, and where there you are, you might say, economies of scale and scope, where elevating it and cooperating has societal benefits because of the advantages of scale. If you do things at a small scale, it often is inefficient. So there are trade-offs, and I've written about, you know, how you balance those trade-offs. The difficulty is that when you have countries with very different values, very different views about how the economy works, it's going to be more difficult to get economic cooperation, which makes everybody happy. If you make rules that make one group happy, you're going to make another group unhappy. And that really is part of the problem with the euro. People talk about the need for convergence economically, that countries had to be similar, and that similarity was the essential characteristic if the single currency was going to work, and they didn't have that. That's why they wanted convergence, but they actually created a diverging system, and that was one of the reasons for the failure. But another reason for the failure is political. The disparity in beliefs were too great, and there's been divergence there too. So the key issue is, how do you respond to a country with a lot of unemployment?
Because they can't manipulate currency in the same way you could if you had your own.
That's right. So Germany's view is, cut your deficit, cut spending, raise taxes, lower wages, all of which leads to a lot of suffering. And the Southern European way is to say, let's use Keynesian economics, the school of thought that's been dominant in the last 75 years, verified by experiments and over again, stimulate the economy. You know, in the United States, it's interesting, even the Republicans agree that you need stimulus when the economy is down. We have a disagreement about what is the best form of stimulus, but there's no disagreement about the need for government intervention to stimulate. Bush did it as well as Clinton, so there's no disagreement. But in Europe, there is that disagreement. They said austerity was going to bring you back to full employment. Now, it's nonsense and didn't work. But if the Germany were doing it on itself, that's one thing. You say, well, they it was a self-inflicted wound. But to have Germany inflicted on Southern Europe is unconscionable and is going to create this political backlash, I think, eventually. It says, you know, this system is not working.
Is there a way to reconcile these two realities? Because obviously, I mean, just culturally, traveling through Europe, there's a vast difference between Germans and Greeks, you know, in terms of how they view life, in terms of how they work, what they, you know, what they value. How do you ever put those two countries under the same umbrella? And so at this point, do you see anything salvageable in this construct, starting with the euro and then moving on to EU?
So let me begin with the EU.
Yeah.
You can have a trade agreement that allows free flow of goods and services with very different values. In Scandinavia, they recognize this kind of free trade is going to have winners and losers. And they say the winners are going to be taxed to compensate the losers, so everybody's a winner. So they say, you know, trade is good, but we're going to make sure that everybody's a winner. In the United States, we have the view, the Republicans have the view, losers are losers. let them suffer. Well, you know, countries could take that as a national choice.
We didn't do that with the banks.
No, we didn't do it with the banks, but you could take that view. So the point I'm trying to make is trade is an area where you could have opening of trade with different values, and it could work. It may not work either, but it can work in principle. Having a single currency is an area where you need a lot more congruence in political beliefs. So that's something where I think unless there is some greater degree of flexibility built in, it won't work. And that's where the idea I have in my book called The Flexible Euro comes in. I say, you know, there's some degree of flexibility that you could build in within each of the national autonomy and some degree of coordination that would lead to exchange rate variations being less than they used to be in the past, but still some degree of variability.
So in your model, if Greece wanted to apply monetary policy to, let's say, inflate the currency and pay off some of their debt, would they be able, under the flex euro, for the flexible euro, would they be able to do that?
Yes, they could. But as they did that, if they inflated the economy, they would have to worry about what that would do to their competitiveness, and they'd have to try to design a policy that would take that into account. They can do that. What I argue in the book is that actually, a more efficient system of adjustment is for the countries that have surpluses, like Germany, to inflate their economies, raise wages, raise the minimum wage, and that is a more efficient way of adjusting than having the adjustment borne by the poorer countries. And when that happens, then, of course, Greece's exchange rate relatively looks more attractive. It then can export more, and that will stimulate its economy. So in the ideal system, that's the way you ought to have adjustment. That's where the idea of the flexible euro, if Germany can show that it is willing to cooperate enough.
Why would they do it? To preserve the EU?
They would do it for two reasons. To preserve the EU, which I think is an important construct, or to preserve this kind of cooperation. They do it for a second reason. Their growth model has been based on large surpluses. As country after country leaves the euro and takes actions that lead them to lower their exchange rate, that's equivalent to the German euro increasing in value. And one way or another, they're going to find that their exports are going to be hurt. They've been engaged in competitive devaluation. They have a workforce that accepts more discipline, you could say, by cutting their wages than other countries. That gives them an advantage, but it's a competitive devaluation. It gives them, they're gaining at the expense of all their trading partners. That's not a viable system.
What are the one or two actions that could be taken today that could either save the currency or put it in on the right path?
One of the things they have to do is create very quickly a banking union, which means common deposit insurance, common resolution when we have failed bank, and common supervision. They've agreed to the principle, but again have pushed out putting common deposit insurance into some distant future. Common deposit insurance is the most important, because without that, money leaves the poor countries, goes to the rich, making the poor countries poorer, increasing the divergence between the poor and the rich. That should be the first thing they do, and they're talking about it being the last thing they do. They need to have a solidarity fund for stabilization. They have to have some way of helping the countries that are weak. And those countries can't do it within their own budget constraint. You have to promote growth. There has to be some cooperation. This is where there's a lot of tension. Germany says we're not a transfer union. And my view is you're not going to have a single currency work for all the people of Europe unless there is enough solidarity to say when a country is facing this temporary state of recession, and let's hope that recession is a temporary state, to get back to its feet. Germany has the view there's something pathological about Greece. The fact is that Greece, before the crisis, was growing faster than the average in Europe.
Yes. They had a scary stat where some crazy percentage of the population worked for the government. It was something in the 40-plus percent.
Not quite hard, but they do have a large fraction, and they need to restructure the economy. That failure to restructure the economy leads to a lower standard of living. That's absolutely clear.
Yeah.
But that's not a reason for having high unemployment and reasonable growth. So these countries with these bag stacks, as you say, had full employment and growth above the average, but low standards of living. they're going to pay a price.
Yeah.
And, you know, you tell them, look, you got to reform if you want to raise your standard of living. But it's really dysfunctional. Nobody wins when you have 25% unemployment.
Europe is getting old. And you look at Japan. Japan's average age is 46. White Europeans, they're somewhere in the 40 to 42 range. Then you look at the immigrant populations, certainly the ones that they've been taking in recently and the ones that have been there. They haven't been integrated into the economy, but they are substantially poorer, but they're also growing considerably faster. How do they rectify that part of the economy?
Well, demography is obviously important and is obviously affecting the whole global economy. Part of the reason why you have all these migration pressures. But countries that have a declining population, like Japan, significantly declining workforce, have managed to have low unemployment, even high growth per working age population. If you ignore that, obviously you get a low growth number. Mm. But if you look adjusting growth for the working age population, Japan has actually been doing pretty well. And what we care about is living standards.
Yeah.
So Europe, if it had the right economic structure, could have rising living standards. I'd say even more, because one of the aspects of living standards is congestion. And trying to create a less congested environment could actually help living standards. So to me, demography is very important, but it's not the cause of the crisis we have today.
You've written so much about inequality, and you've put clearly a ton of thought into it. First, let me start with a very simple question. Would you rather earn $50,000 today or $100,000 in 1980?
The point is, we try to adjust those numbers for changes in the cost of living.
Okay, but let's say it's real, in real terms.
In real terms, yeah. Obviously, there are two things that are going on underlying your question. People care about their own standard of living, but they judge what is going on relative to what else others are doing. And this relative standing is important for a number of reasons. It's important, for instance, because in many areas, access to certain goods depends on your position in society. Access to the best schools.
And $50K won't get you there, is what you're saying.
If you can't buy beachfront property unless you're in the top percent.
So you could have an iPhone. You can scroll through a lot of beachfront property for free.
But you won't be able to live there. And so relative is important. And a lot of research has shown that relative deprivation at the bottom is really important. You know, if you live in a society where everybody has an outhouse and you have a nicer outhouse, that's one thing. But if you live in a society where everybody has indoor plumbing and you are still in an outhouse, you don't feel good about it. So relative, you know, how well you're doing relative is important. What's happening in the United States, though, is it's not just a question of relative. The bottom 90% has had basically stagnant income for a third of a century. Their relative position is declined enormously.
Yeah.
But their absolute position is stagnation. And in a society where the narrative is we're getting better every year, and you say somebody's getting better every year, but our family is not, and the families I know are not, we are worrying about whether our children are going to slip down rather than be able to maintain the standard of living that we have. That's a very different world.
Is education the answer? Is that the great equalizer? Because I know Bernie Sanders, for example, you know, his big platform plank was free education or community college or something like that, public colleges. The challenge with that is almost, I think I saw the stat, I might misquote it, but it was something like 50% of graduates are now in jobs that don't require a degree. It might even be a higher number. So does flooding the market with more graduates solve the problem? Or how do we address this, you know, that gap? Isn't that the great equalizer that gives people the tools to excel?
It's very clear, if you look at the statistics, that education is important. It is one of the equalizers. One of the reasons I and others have focused on the importance of preschool education is that we know that by the time kids are 5 years old, there are big differences that have already been built in. At the other side, increasing cost of tuition is making education more and more unaffordable to those who are, you know, I jokingly say, made the mistake of choosing poor parent. The view we ought to have access for all to the best education for which they are qualified. And we could afford it. You know, we did after World War II. We said, everybody, you could go to the, you know, not just the public school, to a private school. You could go to Harvard if you qualify. To me, saying that we're going to have community college available for all is not good enough. It has to be well beyond that. And again, I think we can afford it. Now, it's not, as you say, a panacea. Part of the problem is that those who don't have college education have seen their wages sink, and that's partly because we've eviscerated the bargaining power of unions. Unions are weaker. We don't have anybody speaking for these people. And that's where, you know, I've argued it's in part the rules of the game, that we changed the rules of the game that shifted income before taxes and transfers, shifted income towards the top and away from the middle and the bottom.
Mike Rowe from Dirty Jobs, he advocates for manufacturing jobs. He says that there are 3 to 5 million that are still available. He says there are 3 to 5 unfilled manufacturing jobs that don't require a degree that manufacturers are willing to train people for. People don't seem to want them. Why is that?
I don't know whether those statistics are right. I haven't studied them. What is true is we've created over the years, you might say, a false economy where everybody aspires to be bankers because bankers get paid so much more than everybody else. Moving pieces of money around seems to be what everybody aspires to. Not the real economy, not innovation in science and technology. It's finance. And so there is something wrong with the values that we've created. And those values are a reflection in a way of how we reward people. You mentioned before the CEOs get paid 400 times the wages of the average worker, but the financiers, it's in the stratosphere. So what are we telling young people? What's important? We're not telling them discovering DNA, that's not important, we don't reward that. Discovering transistor, that's not important, we don't reward that. Discovering the laser is not important, we don't reward that. What's important is figuring out how to create a housing bubble, because those are the guys that made the money. And then figuring out how to break the housing bubble, because those are the guys who made money.
Can we instill a value system without having the reward match the values? In other words, if the money's there, how do you controvert something like that?
The money is there partly because the way we've written the rules. We have a tax system that encourages finance. We have a regulatory system that allowed it to go on in this unfettered way. So my answer is we have to rewrite the rules of the American economy to put more value on things that matter, to say if you are engaged in short-term speculation, you're going to be taxed at a higher rate. Right now, we say if you're engaged in short-term in speculation, like a land speculation, you'll be taxed at a lower rate. Can you believe that? And we have so many other examples of rules that make no sense. Bankruptcy law says that first priority goes to derivatives, the kind of things that played such a big role in the 2008 crisis. We say Trump can go bankrupt multiple times, but a student can't discharge his debt. That's wrong. We need to rewrite a whole gamut of rules and regulations to reflect what I think of are widely shared values.
Who has that kind of will?
Well, I think that there is a strong will in the country, because I think that what I just described is where most Americans are, not necessarily those with political power. And this is where it comes back to the critical issue, reform of our political system. We've gone from one person, one vote to $1, one vote. Curbing the influence of money in politics is why everybody says is the number one item in the agenda, because you're not going to be able to do a lot of the other things unless you do that.
That is great. Thank you so much, Professor. We can go on forever. Everyone's going to send you tuition checks after this, because they're getting a lesson in economics.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
A pleasure.
That's it for this episode of the show. Don't forget to subscribe, tell a friend, and sign up for the Patreon to support the show and get bonus episodes. I'm Steve Factor. See you next week on the McFuture.